and it would be days before the cowboys could patrol the fences again. He smiled. Inside, his belly was smooth and soft, following the contours of the hills and holding the silence of the snow. He looked back at the way he had come. The snowflakes were swirling in tall chimneys of wind, filling his tracks like pollen sprinkled in the mountain lion's footprints. He shook his head the way the deer shook snow away, and yelled out, "Ahua!" Then he ran across the last wide flat to the plateau rim. The snow packed under his feet with a hollow sound. The big snowflakes still crowded behind him like the gauzy curtains in the woman's house. He stood on the rim rock and looked over the edge, down on the dark evergreens and pinon trees growing thick on the steep canyon slopes. He had to walk about 100 yards north to find the place where the trail went down between two big pinon trees. He pulled a pinon cone down from the snowy branches and shook the fat brown pinons into his hand. He ate them as he walked, cracking the shells one by one, working the nut meat loose with his tongue. He split the shells into the snow below the trail and tried to see into the distance below the mesa, over the edge of the steep trail where her house was. Then behind him, he heard someone singing. A man singing a chant. He stopped and listened. His stomach froze tight and sweat ran down his ribs. His heart was pounding, but he was more startled than afraid.
Heya-ana-a, heya-ana-a, kurutsu-ea-ena, kurutsu-ea-ena, to the east below, to the south below, the winter people come. Heya-ana-a. Heya ana a, kurutsu ea ena, kurutsu ea ena, from the west above, from the north above, the winter people come. Ea na a, antlers of wind, hooves of snow, eyes glitter ice, eyes glitter ice. Ea na a, antlers of wind, antlers of wind. Ea na a.
The voice faded in and out, sometimes muffled or lost in the wind. He recognized phrases of the song. He had heard the hunters sing it late in October while they waited for the deer to be driven down from the high slopes by the cold winds and the snow. He waited until the hunters saw him before he spoke. He was carrying a small fork-horned buck across his shoulders, steadying the load by gripping the antlers in one hand and the hind legs in the other. He smiled when he saw Teo. He wore his hair long, tied back with white cotton string in the old style the men used to wear. He had long strings of sky-blue turquoise in his ears, and silver rings on 4 fingers of each hand. His face was wide and brown, and the skin was smooth and soft like an old woman's. Instead of a jacket, he was wearing a long fur vest sewn with gray rabbit pelts. The fur was old, and there were small bald patches where the bare skin showed through. The elbows of the brown flannel shirt were worn thin, as if his elbow bone might poke through any time. But the cap he wore over his ears was made from tawny, thick fur which shone when the wind ruffled through it. It looked like mountain lion skin. "You've been hunting?" he asked, sliding the carcass down from his shoulders into the snow. Teo noticed that he had already tied delicate blue feathers to the tips of the antlers. "I was looking for some cattle." "They're probably down below by now," he said, gesturing at the snow around them and the flakes still falling from the sky. Teo nodded. He was looking at the old rifle slung across the hunter's back. "That's an old one," he said, helping the hunter lift the deer up on his shoulders again. "But it works good," he answered, starting down the trail ahead of Teo. "It works real good. That's the main thing." He started singing again. This time it wasn't a Laguna song. It sounded like a Jemez song, or maybe one from Zuni. He didn't want to interrupt the hunter to ask, but he was wondering where he was from and where he had learned the Laguna song. All he could see as he walked down the trail was snow, blurring the boundaries between the earth and the sky. At the bottom of the trail, he stopped and kicked away the snow until wet sand was exposed. He was looking for some trace of the cattle, manure, or some sign they had been there. The hunter shook his head. You better come inside first and have something to eat. You can look for them later.
Teo followed him to the yard. The leaves of the apricot tree were solid with snow. He looked toward the corral for the mare and the cattle, but it was snowing too hard to see anything. He smelled pinon smoke. The hunter motioned for him to step inside. They stood side by side in front of the corner fireplace. The flames crackled and hissed when they shook the snow from their clothes. The wet leather of Teo's boots and the hunter's elkskin leggings made steam rise around them like mountain fog after a storm. Teo looked into the flames for a long time, feeling stronger and more calm as he got dry. When he finally turned around, they were together, the hunter kneeling beside the woman, placing pinches of cornmeal on the deer's nose, whispering to it. They sat across from him at the table. When they had finished eating, the hunter stood up and pointed out the window.
"The tree," he said to her. "You better fold up the blanket before the snow breaks the branches."
"I'm going out. I'll shake the snow off the branches," Teo said, remembering how one spring, when a late snow fell, he had helped Josiah and Rocky shake the budded apple trees. She nodded and walked into the bedroom. The black storm-patterned blanket was spread open across the gray flagstone. He watched her fold it. He walked to the tree. It was a dome of snow with only the edges and tips of the leaves scattered green across the white. The early storm had caught the tree vulnerable with leaves that caught the snow and held it in drifts until the branches dragged the ground. He slipped his gloves out of his jacket pocket and took hold of the boughs gently, remembering that it was an old tree and the limbs were brittle. He shook the snow off carefully, moving around the tree from the east to the south and from the west to the north, his breath steaming out in front of him. By the time he had shaken a circle of snow and a pile around the tree, the storm had passed. The mesas to the east were obscured by veils of falling snow, and the sky above them was dark blue. But overhead the snowflakes became sparse and floated down slowly on their own weight now that the wind was gone. To the west, the sky was opening into a high gray overcast, and where the clouds were rubbed thin, the streaks of sky were almost blue. The mare whinnied, and he smiled at the way horses remembered those who feed them. She was leaning against the corral gate with her ears pointed at him, alert. She pawed the snow impatiently and pushed her warm nose into his hands. There was a brown crust of blood on the raw skin of her forelegs where she had fallen. Teo walked her to see how she moved, if she was lame. She followed him eagerly. "Do you expect me to feed you after the way you dumped me up there?" He scratched her neck, feeling the thick winter hair. A few days before, it had been a summer coat, and now, suddenly, the winter preparations had been made. He pushed her back from the gate and closed it. She was combing her hair by the window, watching the sky. He watched her take sections of long hair in her hand and comb it with a crude wooden comb. There was something about the way she moved her arms around her head and the soft shift of her breasts with each stroke of the comb, even her breathing, which was intimate. His face felt hot, and he looked away quickly before the hunter walked in. "Aren't you going to ask me?"
"About what?"
He tried to keep his voice calm and soft, but he was afraid she was referring to the night they slept together.
"You didn't even ask me what I thought when your horse came back to the corral without you."
"Oh.
You haven't asked me about your spotted cattle, either."
She was smiling at him now, as if she had guessed the source of his embarrassment.
"I was going to ask you, but I didn't know if, I wasn't sure if your husband..."
She dropped the comb in her lap and clapped her hands together, laughing. The hunter came in from the back room.
"She's giving you a bad time, huh?" he said.
He smiled too, but Teo felt sweat between each of his fingers.
"She's got your cattle, you know."
Teo nodded and glanced at her. She was grinning at him and watching his face while the hunter spoke. "Which way did they come down?" He wanted to sound casual, but all he could think about was how the hunter seemed to know that he and the woman had met before. "Yesterday afternoon," she said. "Early. They came running down the big arroyo, which comes down from the high canyon."
"But how did you catch them?"
"They went just like the runoff goes after a rainstorm, running right down the middle of the arroyo into the trap. That's why it's there. Livestock come down off the mountain that way. All I had to do was go down and close the gate behind them." She twisted her hair around her fingers and pinned it into a knot again. "We catch our horses the same way." She stood up. "Come on, I'll show you." He followed her down the steep trail into the big arroyo. He traced it back into the canyon with his eyes. The gray banks cut a winding track, its curves and twists the print of a snake's belly across the sand. It was only a continuation of the deep canyon orifice that revealed the interior layers of the mountain plateau. The gray clay was slippery, and it stuck to the soles of his boots. The trap for livestock was simple. The people had made such traps for a long time because they were easy to build and because they enable one or two people alone to corral many horses or cattle. The trap took advantage of the way horses and cattle, once they had been driven into a dry arroyo bed, would usually continue following the course of the arroyo because the sides of the banks were steep and difficult to escape. They could be driven deep into an arroyo that way until the banks were 15 or 20 feet high, making it impossible for horses or cattle to escape. Arroyos might be dry for years, but when the heavy rains did come, the runoff carried boulders and logs down the arroyo, where they snagged weeds and sticks and other debris. With a little work, the debris could be shifted, small logs and dry limbs placed between boulders to form a barrier that only floodwater could pour through. He couldn't see the barrier to this trap because it had been carefully built around a curve in the bank where the animals couldn't see it until after they had gone through the opening. Almost anything could be used for a gate, but here unskinned juniper poles had been strung together with baling wire, making them almost indistinguishable from the other driftwood and dry brush collected around the boulders and logs on either side of the gate. Once the animals were inside the trap, it was easy to drag the gate across the opening. The storm left the sky thin and dappled gray, like a molted snakeskin. "An early snow," he said. "Maybe it'll be a wet winter. A good year next year." She didn't say anything. She was stepping carefully over the snow, which had drifted in some places deeper than the tops of her moccasins. The clay and snow were churned into a muddy trench along the gate where the cattle had milled around, pushing their bony heads against the juniper poles, working for another escape. He followed her inside and pulled the gate closed behind them. She walked close to the arroyo bank to avoid the manure and mud. The cattle backed into the far left corner of the barrier. Their eyes were wide and frightened, and some were pawing the mud. Their breathing formed a single cloud of steam that drifted up, floating away over the banks of the arroyo. As they walked closer, the cows crowded closer together, and some of them lowered their heads and snorted as if they were fending off coyotes. He didn't like being on foot in the corral with them because he suspected that human beings mattered very little to them, and it was only the size of the horse, not the rider, which they respected. But the woman wasn't afraid. She stepped closer to the cattle, bending down to inspect their bellies and legs, walking a half circle in the muddy snow, looking at all of them. They watched her tensely. The snow had melted into their hides, washing out the dirt and manure, leaving them silky white. The spots were golden brown. The butterfly brand and Auntie's Rafter 4 were barely visible through the heavy new growth of winter hair. Josiah had wanted something more than the stupid, drooling Herefords the white ranchers had, something more than animals that had to be driven to water like sheep, and whose bellies shrank around their ribs before they would eat cactus or climb the ridges for brush and bark. My uncle was looking for cattle that could survive drought and hard years. She stepped back from them and nodded her head. Her moccasins were muddy. "It's a wonder you got this many back again," she said. "Look." She pointed at the necks of the cows closest to her. Rope burns left dark, scabby welts in half circles. Strips of hide were missing around their fetlocks. "Texas roping," she said. "They wanted these Mexican cattle because they're fast and tough, and no loss to them when they happen to break their legs or their neck." He'd never heard it called Texas roping before. He knew it as steer roping, because they used old stringy Mexican steers rather than more expensive cows or calves. It had come from Texas with the cowboys, and it was almost too simple. They rode massive, powerful roping horses that were capable of jerking down a steer running full speed, knocking the animal unconscious and frequently injuring or killing it. It was the sport of aging cowboys, too slow and heavy to dismount, to wrestle down and tie the animal as they did in calf roping and team tying. He had seen it only once, at the rodeo grounds in Grants. The steer had to stay down for 10 seconds before the roper's time could be recorded. The jackpot had been $300 that day, and the red-faced white man who took it turned in a record time, 6 seconds. But when the men loosened the rope on the steer's neck, it didn't move. They dragged it away behind two horses, one of the forelegs dangling in the hide, shattered. The anger made him lightheaded. But he didn't talk about this other dimension of their perversion, which, like the hunting of the mountain lion, was their idea of sport and fun. They walked back to the corral. She watched him shake the snow off the saddle blanket and lead the mare to drink at the spring. He looked up at the sky. The sun was in the center of the south sky, covered with high gray clouds. "I wonder if they'll come looking for the cattle." She shrugged her shoulders, unconcerned. "They won't come down here," she said. "Why not?" She gave him a look that chilled him. She must have seen his fear, because she smiled and said, "Because of all the snow up there. What else?" She was teasing again. He shook his head. "I'll get back here and get them as soon as I can," he told her. He took a long time tightening the cinch and checking the leather lacing in the stirrups. He wanted to say something to let her know how good it felt to have her standing close to him. But the hunter was still in the house, so he said nothing. As he stepped over to tie the bedroll behind the saddle, he brushed against her side gently, and she smiled. She knew. She walked close to him as he led the mare out of the corral gate. She pointed at the dusky clouds in the northeast sky. "It'll be cold tonight. The mud and snow will freeze." "I hope so," he said. "Otherwise the truck'll get stuck so deep we won't be able to get it out until next spring." She laughed and nodded. "Goodbye," he said. "I'll be seeing you," she said. And he turned to wave at her. She was gone. Robert stayed in the big stake bed truck they had borrowed from their cousin Romero. Teo went to the door. The apricot tree had dropped yellow leaves all around its dark arched branches, and the wind now scattered them around Teo's feet. His knocking echoed far inside. He couldn't smell any wood smoke, and he heard no sounds inside. He pushed the door open and went in. He could see his own breath as he walked through the empty rooms to the kitchen. He smelled clay and old pine from the vigas in the ceiling. The kerosene lamps were gone, and the coffee pot was pushed to the back of the stove. He stepped through the low doorway into the back room where they had slept together. The curly goat hides and the blankets were gone. The bare plaster floor was swept clean, but on the north wall of the room there was an old war shield hanging from a wooden peg set into the white clay wall. He didn't remember seeing it before. It was made from a hide, elk, or maybe buffalo, heavy and stiff enough to stop stones and arrows. Long, dry years had shrunk and split the edges, and it had lost the round shape. At first he thought the hide had turned black from age, but he touched it and realized it had been painted black. There were small white spots of paint all over the shield. He stepped back. It was a star map of the overhead sky in late September. It was the big star constellation old Batoni had drawn in the sand. Nobody home, he told Robert. The cattle had been driven from the trap in the arroyo to the corral where they could water in the pond.
Somebody fed them good, Robert said, pointing at the pile of dry corn stalks on the ground in the corral.
He backed the big truck up to the loading chute. Teo swung the tailgate open. He stood in the corral behind the cattle and waved his arms at them until one by one they hesitantly stepped into the back of the cattle truck.
They look real good, Teo, Robert said. Somebody's been looking after them for you.
So old Batoni did some good after all, old Grandma kept saying.
She was sitting by her kerosene stove, cracking pinons with her front teeth. She'd been sick in early December, and her corner by the stove still smelled like Vicks and Ben Gay. She wore the old black cardigan all the time now, even on warm days, and she insisted on keeping her legs wrapped up in strips of an old wool blanket.
You're all right now, aren't you, Sonny?
Yeah, Grandma, I'm okay now. He was cleaning the .22, getting ready to go after rabbits. Auntie looked at him, but when he looked up at her, she turned away to the stove to the simmering stew and boiling coffee. She'd been watching him. She was waiting. She didn't trust the peace they had in the house now. She was waiting. He dreamed with her. Dreams that lasted all night. Dreams full of warm, deep caressing and lingering desire, which left him sleeping peacefully until dawn, when he would wake up at the first dim light with her presence and the feeling that she had been with him all night. He got up then, moving quietly in the dark house, hearing the snores of Robert and old Grandma. Auntie slept too quietly, and on these mornings when he buttoned up his jacket and went out the door, he imagined she was watching him. He stood on the edge of the sandrock shelf that underlay Laguna and looked east across the river before dawn.
Sunrise. Sunrise.
His words made vapor in the cold morning, and he felt he was living with her this way. He walked back to the house with the sun climbing behind him, warming his back, and he chopped wood and waited until he smelled smoke from the stovepipe. Then he carried an armload of kindling inside. Sometimes Auntie looked at him in a way that could only mean she was recalling the winters before, when he had lain in the bed vomiting and crying. He'd been working with Robert every day, hauling loads of juniper and pinon for the woodpile, bringing coal from Canyoncito to shovel into the shed. They checked on the speckled cattle once a week to see if they had left the canyons around the springs, but the cattle seemed content to stay there, at least for the winter. They took soda pop and comic books to Pinky at sheep camp. Pinky leaned against the juniper logs of the sheep pen. He kept his thin arms pulled close to his sides and his hands jammed tight in the front pockets of his jeans. He wasn't paying any attention to Robert or Teo, who were examining the old ewes. He stared off in the distance toward Gallup. The shirt tails of his short-sleeved pearl-button western shirt flapped around him in the wind. He never tucked in shirt tails, not even in the army, he said, where he spent a month in the brig for it. His face was sullen when he talked about it. They wrestled with a pregnant ewe that bleated and tried to jerk her manure-stained hind legs from their hands. They didn't want to throw her down, and Teo looked up from the struggling animal to see if Pinky was coming to help out by grabbing hold of her head. But he was looking the other way, oblivious to the scuffling and noise, opening the blades on his pocket knife one by one and stabbing them into the juniper post. When they were ready to leave that day, Pinky came out of the little stone sheep camp house. He was wearing his sunglasses with the dark blue lenses and a new black cowboy hat. He carried the rest of his things in a shopping bag. Teo moved over on the truck seat to make room for him. Nobody said anything because Pinky had already stayed at sheep camp a week longer than he ever had before. "Drop me off at the highway," he said. The March winds were warm, and they melted the snow. The road was rutted in sticky red mud, and Robert had to put the truck in low gear and gun it to cross the flats by Prairie Dog Hill. They bounced and skidded, and Pinky braced his hand against the dashboard. The wheels slipped, but then pulled again, and Teo could feel by the momentum of the truck that they'd make it. They stopped at the highway to wipe the mud off the windshield. Pinky got out. He pulled his hat down low over his eyes and picked up his shopping bag. He walked down the highway with his thumb high in the air, and he didn't look back. He was going up the line, to walk, hitchhike, and maybe ride in Leroy's truck, up Highway 66 to Dixie Tavern, San Fidel, Cerritos, all the way to Gallup and back again, with stops in between, Bebo, the Y, until the money ran out. He was dreaming of her arms around him strong when the rain on the tin roof woke him up. But the feeling he had, the love he felt from her, remained. The wet earth smell came in the window that Robert had propped open with an old shoe the night before. He was overwhelmed by the love he felt for her. Tears filled his eyes, and the ache in his throat ran deep into his chest. He ran down the hill to the river, through the light rain until the pain faded like fog mist. He stood and watched the rainy dawn, and he knew he would find her again. A few days before the end of May, he told them he was going to the ranch to stay. Robert nodded. He was busy with the fields at New Laguna, and this way Teo could look after the cattle and new calves. Auntie looked up from a black book of church devotions, one she'd been reading since Easter. She looked satisfied, as if she'd been waiting all winter for him to say something like that. "I don't want any of those others around. They can do their drinking someplace else, not at our place." Her face was stiff, and her lips barely moved as she spoke. She had expected that sooner or later he'd want to go off with the others, Pinky and Harley and the rest of them, to go drinking and hell-raising, to give her more to worry over. The same things his mother had done, to bring disgrace to the family. "Gather up some Indian tea for me," old Grandma called to him from the back room. "You hear me? I said pick me some tea." She came through the door, shuffling more slowly than last year, using her cane all the time now. She still wore her black sweater and the blanket leggings, although the weather had been warm for some time now. When she sat down next to her stove, her movements were stiff and slow. "One more thing," old Grandma said. "One more thing, Teo. Old man Koosh came around the other day. He said maybe pretty soon you'd have something to tell them. He said maybe you'd go talk to them sometime." After Robert had driven away, he walked around. The yellow-striped cat and the black goat followed him. The cat pounced on grasshoppers in the green tumbleweeds and ate them from the curve of her claws. The goat lagged behind to nibble sprouts of new grass before tossing her head and bounding after him to catch up again. The red clay flats had dried into brittle curls where the standing water had been baked out by the sun. But shining under the sun as far as he could see down the valley, many more puddles remained, full of red, muddy water. The valley was green, from the yellow sandstone mesas in the northwest to the black lava hills to the south. But it wasn't the green color of the jungles, suffocating and strangling the earth. The new growth covered the earth lightly, each blade of grass, each leaf and stem with space between, as if planted by a thin summer wind. There were no dusty red winds spinning across the flats this year. The gray mule was gone, his bones unfolding somewhere on the red dirt, bleached white and thin in the sun. The changes pulled against themselves inside him. The mule had been blind and old, but his room was the same. The creaking bedsprings and the frame pushed into the southeast corner below the small window. The terror of the dreaming he had done on this bed was gone, uprooted from his belly. And the woman had filled the hollow spaces with new dreams. The buzzing of grasshopper wings came from the weeds in the yard, and the sound made his backbone loose. He lay back in the red dust on the old mattress and closed his eyes. The dreams had been terror at loss, at something lost forever. But nothing was lost. All was retained between the sky and the earth, and within himself. He'd lost nothing. The snow-covered mountain remained without regard to titles of ownership or the white ranchers who thought they possessed it. They logged the trees, they killed the deer, bear, and mountain lions, they built their fences high. But the mountain was far greater than any or all of these things. The mountain outdistanced their destruction, just as love had outdistanced death. The mountain couldn't be lost to them because it was in their bones. Josiah and Rocky weren't far away. They were close. They'd always been close. And he loved them then as he had always loved them, the feeling pulsing over him as strong as it had ever been. They loved him that way. He could still feel the love they had for him. The damage that had been done had never reached this feeling. This feeling was their life, vitality locked deep in blood memory. And the people were strong, and the fifth world endured. And nothing was ever lost as long as the love remained. He got up and went outside. The sun was behind the clouds, and the air was cool. There were blue-bellied clouds hanging low over the mountain peaks, and he could hear thunder faintly in the distance. He walked north along the road. A year before, he had ridden the blind mule, and Harley rode the burro. Patoche was standing high and clear. Months and years had no relation to the colors of gray slate and yellow sandstone circling it. Only the sky had changed, washed clear of the dust and haze which had swirled off the red clay flats the summer before. He could smell wild flowers growing in the weeds and grass beside the road, and he heard the big bumblebees and the smaller bees sucking the blossoms. The flowers were all colors of yellow that day, silky yellow petals like wild canary feathers, and blossoms as dark as the center of the sun. He found flowers that had no bees and gathered yellow pollen gently with a small blue feather from Josiah's pouch. He imitated the gentleness of the bees as they brushed their sticky-haired feet and bellies softly against the flowers. He continued north, looking to the yellows and the orange of the sandrock cliffs ahead, and to the narrow sandrock canyons that cut deep into the mesa, exposing the springs. He was wondering about the speckled cattle, whether they had pushed their way through the fence and were halfway to Mexico by now. They had been so difficult to control in the beginning. They had taken so much from Josiah. He left the road and took a trail that cut directly to the cliffs, winding up the chalky gray hill where the mesa plateau ended in crumbling shale above the red clay flats. The sun felt good. He could smell the juniper and pinon still damp from the rain. The wind carried a wild honey smell from meadows of beeweed. The trail dipped into a shallow wash. The sand was washed pale and smooth by rainwater and wind. He knelt and touched it. He pulled off his boots and socks and dug his toes deep into the damp sand. Then he started walking again. Up ahead, a snake stopped and raised its head alertly. The tongue slid in and out and then stopped when it located him. It was a light yellow snake covered with bright copper spots, like the wild flowers pulled loose and traveling. It crossed the wash and wound its way up the slope, disappearing into the grass. He knelt over the arching tracks the snake left in the sand and filled the delicate imprints with yellow pollen. As far as he could see, in all directions, the world was alive. He could feel the motion pushing out of the damp earth into the sunshine. The yellow spotted snake, the first to emerge, carrying this message on his back to the people. She was walking through the sunflowers, holding the blue silk shawl around her shoulders in one hand, carrying the long, curved willow stick in the other. She turned to him as soon as he saw her, as if she'd been waiting. The nights of soft dreaming of her were suddenly locked tight in his chest, and his heart beat fast. "I'm camped up by the spring," she said, pointing at the canyon ahead of them. "Here, this way. I'll show you." She sat in the shade of the willows that grew beside the pool, below the overhang of the cliff. She sat with her legs straight out in front of her, holding the red calico skirt in both hands, pulled tight around her legs like trousers. She wiggled her bare toes and looked up at the sandstone cliffs where the swallows were inside their round mud nests, making high-pitched noises. The shadows of the willow leaves made her skin look mottled and dark, the way the iron deposits streaked the yellow sandstone cliffs dark orange. He squatted in the sand at the edge of the pool and looked into the shallow, clear water. The sand at the bottom caught the color of the sun, and tiny green leaves grew out of this color, suspended in the still water. Shiny black water beetles pushed across the bottom of the pool, leaving trails of tiny air bubbles twisting to the surface. Except for the rustle of the swallows and a mourning dove calling from the mouth of the canyon, it was quiet. The sunlight moved up and down his back like hands, and he felt the muscles of his neck and belly relax. He lay down beside the pool, across from her, and closed his eyes. He dreamed he made love with her there. He felt the warm sand on his toes and knees. He felt her body, and it was as warm as the sand, and he couldn't feel where her body ended and the sand began. He woke up, and she was gone. His fists were full of sand, and he was sweating. The sun had moved across the sky, and he knew he had slept for hours. He washed his face in the water. The surface water was still warm, so he plunged his hands deep into the cool layer above the yellow sand. As he walked from the pool to the place she had been sitting, the moisture on his hands and face evaporated. He looked for an imprint of her feet, or the outline that the cloth of her skirt made in the sand. As he moved through the grass around the pool, a small green frog wiggled out of the weeds ahead of him and splashed into the pool. He felt shaky inside. What if there were no traces of her? No lines of sand pressed by her body? No delicate track of her blue shawl trailing into the weeds? The imprints were there. He traced his fingers lightly along them. He hadn't dreamed her. He was there as certainly as the sparrows had been there, leaving spindly scratches in the mud. "I'm over here," she said. Her voice came from the east side of the narrow canyon. He scrambled over the big rocks. A chipmunk skittered ahead of him. He was afraid she'd disappear like the echo her voice made. His bare feet and the ends of his toes were raw from the sand rock. He stood on the boulder above her, breathing hard. She was sitting on the edge of a sandy bank beside a big moonflower plant. The blue silk shawl was spread open by her feet, and she had filled it with freshly dug roots and leaves from many different plants. She gathered up the shawl without looking at him and climbed up the rock to join him. They climbed a steep trail where niches for toes and fingers had been worn into the yellow sand rock after centuries of use. She pulled herself to the top with a branch of bearberry shrub and offered him her hand. Coming over the edge, the canyon and the rock of the cliff seemed suddenly gone, as if he had stepped from the earth into the sky. Where they were, the sky was more than half the world. It enclosed the mesa top where they stood. "You never told me your name," he said. "I'm a Montaño," she said. "You can call me Te'e. That's my nickname because my Indian name is so long. All of us kids did that." He nodded. "We did that too, at home. Nicknames." He thought about Rocky then. His baptismal name had been Augustine, and Rocky had been as close as he had wanted to come to the Indian name old Grandma's sister had given him. "You have brothers and sisters," he said, wanting to find out about her. "Yes," she said, looking off into the distance toward the Black Mountains in the south. "We're all very close, a very close family." He started to ask where they were then, where they lived, because he had only met the hunter. But her eyes were shining, and they told him things that her words never said. "I have a sister who lives way down that way. She's married to a Navajo from Red Lake." She pointed south in the direction she was looking. "Another lives near Flagstaff. My brother's in Jemez." She stopped suddenly and laughed. "You know what they say about the Montaños?" The tone of her voice said that of course he knew what the people said about her family, but Teo couldn't remember hearing of that family. "Up here, we don't have to worry about those things." She was right. They would leave the questions of lineage, clan, and family name to the people in the village, to someone like Auntie, who had to know everything about anyone. They walked back together. In the distance, he could see the spotted cattle scattered across the valley between the mesas. The yellow bull their cousin Romero lent them was grazing a distance from the cows, as if he still feared their horns. Their hides reflected the color of the sunset, like clouds on the west horizon. "How did you know I'd be here?" he said, still watching the cattle. She laughed and shook her head. "The way you talk," she said. "I was here almost a week before you came. How did you know that I'd be here? Tell me that first." He went with her to learn about the roots and plants she had gathered. When she found a place, she got comfortable, spreading her blue shawl on the ground after she had cleared the area of pebbles and little sticks and made sure no ants were disturbed. She sat flat on the ground and bent over close to the plants, examining them for a long time, from the petals, sprinkled with pollen, down the stem to each leaf, and finally to the base, where she carefully dug the sand away from the roots. "This one contains the color of the sky after a summer rainstorm. I'll take it from here and plant it in another place, a canyon where it hasn't rained for a while." While she gathered plants, he watched the cattle grazing in the tall yellow rice grass that grew above the arroyo just to the edge of the juniper trees. They had stopped moving south. They had worked the direction out of their systems and had settled into the place. Josiah would have said that it was because they were so smart, and they could tell a good place when they found it, springs and good grazing. "And what about Romero's yellow bull?" he could hear Josiah say, winking when he said that. But the speckled cows hadn't seen the yellow bull that way, at least not in the beginning. Romero's bull was short-legged and broad, and his color was yellow sand rock broken loose from a cliff. He had small yellow eyes and a hump in his neck. Romero found him standing on three legs at the Pruitt rodeo grounds the day after a rodeo. The left front leg was hanging at a broken angle, and none of the white people at Pruitt wanted to bother with the bull because the meat would be tough. Romero told them he would haul the bull away for free. Romero said he didn't know how dangerous the bull might be after being a rodeo bull, but the horns were sawed off blunt, and he had only three good legs, so Romero took him home and doctored him. He said he worked on the animal in the loading chute, but the bull stood still and never fought while Romero worked on him. Romero busted up an orange crate and used the wooden slats for a splint that he tied up with strips of old bedsheet. It was a perfect job, Romero said, only the damn bull had rubbed the leg against the corral posts and loosened the splint too soon. That's why the leg healed a little crooked. If he'd just left it alone, it would have been almost as good as new, Romero said. The speckled cows had watched the bull step out of the horse trailer, and when he sniffed them out and started to approach them, they crowded together, shaking their heads and the curved horns, threatening with wild eyes. They had moved suddenly, like a whirlwind, dust and sand flying up from their hooves as they chased him back toward the truck and horse trailer. But there he spun around suddenly to face them, and they scattered. He watched them disappear into the junipers of the wide canyon to the west, and then he switched his stubby tail around his haunches a few times and trotted after them. The yellow bull grazed in open view, but the speckled cows stayed in the juniper, listening like deer to Teo's approach, their spotted hides blending into the sandy talus of the big mesa. Gradually they appeared, cautiously joining the yellow bull. Teo sat motionless with his back against the small cottonwood tree growing in the wash. The cows kept their bodies between him and the new calves, but occasionally a calf bolted away, bucking and leaping in a wide arc, returning finally to its mother when it tired of playing. Teo's heart beat fast. He could see Josiah's vision emerging. He could see the story taking form in bone and muscle. "There's only one more I need," she said, pointing her chin in the direction of the gunny sacks full of roots and plants. "It won't be ready for a while, but I'll show you which one it is, and maybe you can gather it for me in case I have to go before it's ready." Teo had been drowsing in the sun with his back against the cliff rock. He sat up stiffly and looked at her. In case of what?
His heartbeat was fast and unsteady. Her eyes had distance in them. When he looked at her, he saw miles spreading into canyons and hills. She knelt down beside him, and he saw tears.
Out there, she whispered, things are always moving, always shifting. I hear them sometimes at night.
They walked west along the long mesa where the old ones had piled stones in circles, high above the flat sandstone mesa top, far above the canyons and springs.
This one, she said, pointing at a tall, dark green plant with round, pointed leaves, deep-veined like fossil shells. The flat seed pods were still thick and green, but later, in the fall, the skin would dry thin, and cold winds would strip away the hull to the last translucent membrane holding the dark eyes of the seed inside it.
What color of sky is inside this one?
She shook her head. This isn't for color, she said. It's for light. The light of the stars and the moon penetrating the night. It was too dense and green to be taken then. If the stem were broken then, before the final season, its wet, flowing vitality would be lost in a single breath.
I'll remember it, he said. I'll gather it for you if you're not here.
Their days together had a gravity emanating from the mesas and arroyos, and it replaced the rhythm that had been interrupted so long ago. Now the old memories were less than the constriction of a single throat muscle. She was with him again, a heartbeat unbroken where time subsided into dawn, and the sunset gave way to the stars wheeling across the night. The breaking and crushing were gone, and the love pushed inside his chest. And when he cried now, it was because she loved him so much.
Robert came at the end of the summer. He had come only once before, when he took the goat and the cat back to Laguna, and he stopped to see if Teo needed anything. Robert hadn't asked any questions then about why Teo was sleeping out there when he could have stayed over at the ranch. This time, Teo could see something different, although they walked up the valley together as they had when Robert came before, looking at the spotted cattle, examining the calves. When they got back to the place Robert parked the truck, Robert looked uneasy.
What should I tell them at Laguna?
Robert was looking up at the thunderclouds rolling in from the Black Mountains in the south. The roads out that way had been muddy all summer, and he didn't want to get stuck that day.
Teo shook his head. A hawk circled high above them, gliding on air currents from the approaching storm. Thunder echoed against the cliffs, but Robert didn't go. He took his hat off and wiped his forehead on his shirt sleeve.
They want you to come home. They're worried about you. They think you might need the doctors again.
Oh. His stomach fell into a crevice. His hands felt cold.
Old man Kuush and some of the others are wondering, too, why you haven't come. They thought maybe there might be something you should tell them.
The words caught in his throat, and he coughed.
And Emo has been saying things about you. He's been talking about how you went crazy and are alone out here. Talks bullshit about caves and animals.
Teo had never heard Robert talk that way before. He had never seen him angry before. Teo felt lightheaded and weak. Robert sounded sad.
You know how people are about things like that. White people are that way, too. The army might send someone to take you back.
Lightning flashed across the dark blue clouds, but for Teo, the bolt zigzagged slowly up the dark mountain peaks of cloud, taking longer than Robert's words had taken to reach him.
Maybe if you came back for a while, you know, so they could see that you're all right, so you could talk to them, and then they could see what a liar Emo is.
He nodded at Robert, but he was involved with other things. Memories and shifting sounds heard in the night. Diamond patterns, black on white. The energy of the designs spiraled deep, then protruded suddenly into three-dimensional summits, their depth and height dizzy and shifting with the eye. Raindrops rattled on the hood of the pickup. Robert kicked at the left front tire. The recap was beginning to peel loose.
"Thanks," Teo said. "Thanks for telling me."
He watched Robert drive away. The rain ran down his hair into his shirt. It had grown below his ears and touched his neck. He thought of Emo then, always with a GI haircut.
"Death isn't much," she said.
She was sitting on the sand with her feet out straight in front, arranging short willow twigs into bundles, tying them with fluffy cotton string that she had twisted by hand. They had found a calf in the arroyo that morning. Small black ants were already making trails across the head, from the nose to the eyes. The belly was bloating out as the sun climbed higher in the sky.
"Sometimes they don't make it. That's all. It isn't very far away."
She looked up at him intently and then continued.
"There are much worse things, you know. The destroyers. They work to see how much can be lost, how much can be forgotten. They destroy the feeling people have for each other."
He took a deep breath. It hurt his chest. He thought of Josiah then, and Rocky.
"Their highest ambition is to gut human beings while they're still breathing, to hold the heart still beating so the victim will never feel anything again. When they finish, you watch yourself from a distance and you can't even cry, not even for yourself."
He recognized it then. The thick white skin that had enclosed him, silencing the sensations of living, the love as well as the grief. And he had been left with only the hum of the tissues that enclosed him. He never knew how long he had been lost there, in that hospital in Los Angeles.
"They're all around now. Only destruction is capable of arousing a sensation, the remains of something alive in them. And each time they do it, the scar thickens, and they feel less and less, yet still hungering for more."
She gathered up the bundles of twigs and started walking southwest.
"Old Batoni said there was some way to stop."
"It all depends," she said.
"How far you're willing to go."
They walked together over the sandy ridge above the wash, across stones that had tumbled down from the clay mortar of walls washed away by time, the geometric patterns of rooms and kivas flowing into the white arroyo sand, where even the shards of pottery were rolled to pebbles, all their colors and designs soaked back into the earth. The position of the sun in the sky was delicate, transitional, and the season was unmistakable. The sky was the early morning color of autumn, Hemez turquoise edged with thin quartz clouds. He breathed deeply, trying to inhale the immensity of it, trying to take it all inside himself, the way the arroyo sand swallowed time. She was looking at Patoche, and the hair was blowing around her face. He could feel where she had come from, and he understood where she would always be. The she-elk was bigger than life, painted in pale lavender clay on the south face of sandstone along the base of the cliff. Her great belly was swollen with new life as she leaped across the yellow sand rock, startled forever across the curve of cliff rock, ears flung back to catch a sound behind her. The priests who painted her each year always cried when they stood back from the cliff and saw her.
"Amu'u, Amu'u, you are so beautiful. You carry all that life, Amu'u. With you, the cliff comes alive."
They restacked the stones that had fallen. She laid the willow stick she had tied inside the small square enclosure, and he laid a flat sandstone over the opening at the top. The rain and wind were overtaking her, rubbing away the details of her legs. The sun was bleaching her hooves into faint outlines, merging into the cliff. "It's almost gone," he said. "The clay is washing away," she said. "Nobody has come to paint it since the war. But as long as you remember what you've seen, then nothing is gone. As long as you remember, it's part of this story we have together." They stayed until the sun had gone to the end of the valley, and the she-elk was a dark blue shadow on the cliff. She laid a dry pinon branch on the coals. Smoke curled out of the gray, scaly bark like woolly hair until yellow flames burst around it. He saw her face in the light that came suddenly and bright. She was crying. He wanted to kneel down and put his arms around her and tell her not to cry, but his connection with the ground was solid. His arms clasped his knees to his chest like arms of another person, pulling numb legs to a strange chest. Only his brain moved, wet and heavy against the contours of his skull, favoring curvatures of bone and concave niches. When he spoke, it was from a mouth independent of himself, and he had to listen to the sound of the words to know what he was saying. "What is it? Why are you crying?" The anger in his voice surprised him. She looked at him. The skin on her face was darker where she had smeared the tears with the back of her hand. "The end of the story. They want to change it. They want it to end here, the way all their stories end, encircling slowly to choke the life away. The violence of the struggle excites them, and the killing soothes them. They have their stories about us, Indian people who are only marking time and waiting for the end. And they would end this story right here, with you fighting to your death alone in these hills. Doctors from the hospital and the BIA police come. Some of the old men from Laguna come, too. They drive over there in their patrol cars." She pointed across the big arroyo to the place where the sandy wagon road was washed out. "They walk this way. The doctors have medicine to quiet you. The others bring guns. Emo's told them that you're crazy, that you live in the cave here and you think you're a Jap soldier. They're all afraid of you." Her eyes filled with tears again. "They'll call to you, friendly voices. If you come quietly, they'll take you and lock you in the white walls of the hospital. But if you don't go with them, they'll hunt you down and take you any way they can. Because this is the only ending they understand." "How do you know?" His stomach churned up a hot taste in his throat. She stared up at the sky for a long time. A shooting star arched from west to east, scattering light behind it like dust on a trail. When she didn't answer, he knew. Like old Batoni, she could see reflections in sandrock pools of rainwater, images shifting in the flames of juniper fire. She heard voices, low and distant in the night. "One thing," she said finally, looking down at the red coals in the ring of white ash. "There are only a few others with Emo. The rest have been fooled. They're being used. Tools. The army people don't know. They don't know about stories or the struggle for the ending to the story. White people are always busy. They'll ask themselves, what is one Indian veteran living in a cave in the middle of some reservation? They won't have much time for you. The only reason they come is because Emo called them." "And the old men from home?" "They come very reluctantly, because the government people ask them to come along. They don't like white people coming around anyway. The only thing is, they haven't been able to agree."
"Agree on what?"
"They're trying to decide who you are." She poked the coals with a stick. "If they didn't find you right away, the white people would get impatient." He nodded and smiled. The squeezing around his chest faded. He knew the rest of the story.
"They won't want to climb around these hills. They're afraid of snakes. Their government cars will get stuck in sand and muddy places. The old men will get tired of sitting in the hot sun watching the white men act like fools. They'll all go home," Teo said.
That leaves Imo and the others, she said, unrolling their blankets on the sand. And that part won't be easy. He held her fiercely all night, as if together their sweat and the heat of their breathing could lock out the moaning voices of the dark, whirling winds. Together they made a place, remote and calm as the stars that lay across the sky. He woke up in the night and found that place as he moved close to her again. Before dawn, he felt her breathing close to his face, and when he opened his eyes, she was smiling at him. The cattle stood motionless in the thick yellow light from the edge of the sun, visible above the horizon. There was a density to the light which seemed to hold them, as if the sudden warmth had stopped them, and they didn't move when she and Teo walked past.